All right, what's up, y'all? Welcome back to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. If you're listening to most of these, then you probably know we're at the Sports Medicine Update provided by Memorial Hermann. Dr. Mark Knobloch is going to be heading up this interview. Bubba Wilson will be jumping in. And we have two of the Masters of Athletic Training students. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
I'm Carson Payne.
And I'm Allison Crandall.
All right, so we got Carson and Allison there helping us out. And Jasmine Dozal is here helping out with all the recording stuff today. If you're looking at the camera, you can just barely see her head. But she's a huge help for me today, doing the recording and making my job easier. We're going to talk to Dr. Latino Ramos about pediatric or the pre-participation exam from a pediatric cardiologist point of view. And so Dr. Knobloch and I recently talked to Dr. John Higgins about this, and it was a week before the House bill went up for voting or something like that about requiring the EKGs. And so it would be interesting to hear your perspective here. And, of course, Dr. Knobloch has got a special interest, and I'm sure he'll talk about that some to you, Dr. Ramos. So without much further ado, I'm going to leave it with you, Dr. Knobloch.
You got it. Thank you.
So, Dr. Ramos, could you just kind of give us a little, just for the listeners, a brief background, how you ended up in cardiology, why pediatrics versus adults, and, you know, when there's so much business in, you know, adult cardiology in this country, but just kind of a little background.
Right. Pediatrics for me was always my passion in medical school. I always enjoyed working with children. I always felt that, you know, children were very resilient. You know, they could withstand, you know, such tremendous medical ordeals and come out on the other side sometimes better than where they started. And, you know, just have a, you know, they're just the ability to make them better and make them healthier so that they could live long, healthy lives, to me was always very rewarding. I think working with adults and elderly patients also has its own rewards, but I always enjoyed children.
So, let's kind of jump in right here.
Sure.
So obviously the hot topic is ECGs mm-hmm. during pre-participation.
Right.
So in my experience, we have the conflicting theories. We have our Italians, we have Corrado and Pellicci, and we have Barry Marone over on the American side. And the Italians said you need to do ECGs during pre-participation physical exams. Here's our evidence. We've reduced sudden cardiac death 90% since we started. The American, traditional American thought process is, yes, they're effective, but they're not cost-effective. They reduce or result in a lot of false positives. So kind of it seems to me that the American side has been changing a little bit more in the last few years. Would you agree that we're kind of now starting to see the benefits, or would you say that there's still pretty good debate on whether or not to include them outside of the whole AG 767 and legislation?
I think there's still a lot of discussion. Even within the pediatric cardiology community itself, there's a lot of heated debate going back and forth. And I think a lot of that has reached the awareness of the American public more recently with the Texas bill that was in front of the legislature recently. But it's still a very heated debate. I think we're hearing a little bit more about it, but I don't think that we're any closer to any consensus. There's still a lot of division. In terms of the screenings that are being done in Italy, the Italians argue that it's very effective for them, I think more so because they see a different spectrum of disease than what we see here in the U.S.
ARVD, right?
Mm-hmm. ARVD, exactly. That's something that is a lot more prevalent in Italy than it is here in the United States. So if you just screen, say, 1,000 children, you're going to see a lot higher proportion of that disease in Italy than if we screen the same 1,000 children here in the U.S.
Is there a reason why ARVD is more prevalent in Italy versus HCM in the United States? It seems weird. It seems like they should be similar.
Well, I think it just has to do with the genes in that part of the country, in that part of the world. You have parts of the world that you know, have had very little migration over, you know, centuries, and so you see a lot more diseases in that population in the community. For example, Ashkenazi Jewish people have a higher incidence of Tay-Sachs and other inborn errors of metabolism. But the same thing for the Italians. They see a lot more ARVD. So I think to extrapolate their experience to the U.S. nationally, I think would be very, very challenging. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't think about it, But I think we have to be hesitant to say that we're going to find the same number of cases, the same types of cases as they are.
And Bubba, feel free to jump in.
If I remember right from the reading I've done and researching this, didn't the Italian study basically take their numbers down to the American numbers from their screening for this condition? They're saying, yeah, we've got this drop, but they were able to take an ECG and look for a specific issue that basically brought their numbers down to what we were finding in America on our screen.
Right, right.
Is that right?
I don't remember their methodology on that particular study that. on their particular study that you're citing, I think one of the other important differences between the screening studies that are being done in, say, Italy or Japan or some of the other countries, a lot of the other countries have a national healthcare system that also facilitates doing EKG screenings on an entire population. We don't have that here yet, and whether we'll have that here in the next 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, it's hard to know. But that's also an important limitation, and I think it is an important part of the discussion that we need to talk about is the cost of these screening tests, but not just the screening test itself. It's the additional evaluation, the follow-up, the additional evaluation, the treatment, not just of the student athlete, but of the siblings or the parents. A lot of these conditions that we're screening for sudden cardiac death have a genetic basis, like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or long QT syndrome. If we find that one of the students has the condition, there may be a 50% chance that one of the siblings has the condition, and one of the parents may be the reason for the child having a condition. So that hasn't been addressed. And I think that until we are able to have a discussion about all of the issues related to screening, I think we're still going to be at an impasse where you have some people that are very fervent advocates and others that are staunch opponents.
And I think part of it too, and Bubba, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is a very passionate type of legislation. Is, you know, there's a death or something, and then it becomes, you know, what could we have done? Why didn't we prevent this? Do we need to cancel the sports and all that? But when you talk about numbers and costs, there's an argument also not to just necessarily screen everybody, but just target your population. We know that males are 10-to-1 ratio of sudden cardiac death, which is different than obviously a heart attack or specific condition, but sudden cardiac death, and then African Americans. And then we have basketball players. So when you look at male African American basketball players as a target, some people look at that as that's where your problems are going to get caught. Others say, you can't do that. You need to screen everybody. How do you feel on that?
Well, being the father of two girls, I think I would have a problem with if they only screen the boys.
Exactly. Exactly.
I would want my two girls to benefit from the same screening. You know, if that was available to the male student athletes, and I'd want my girls to participate as well. And I'm not sure I'm not the only dad to feel that way. But I think the cost of this type of screening is a very important part of the problem. And I think we need to continue having more discussions on how to address that point so that we can come to a consensus of how to do this for everyone. Now, very recently, I had two children come to my clinic for follow-up after they had a screening EKG that was flagged as abnormal. And both of these students had been playing for years, you know, their respective sport, one boy and a girl, had no symptoms. Never had an episode of chest pain or palpitations or syncope. They have no family history of sudden death or heart disease. They have a normal physical exam, but they showed up to a screening event as voluntarily. It wasn't required by the school. They showed up voluntarily, and they had an abnormal screen.
Now, so this was ECG?
An ECG.
Just history.
Yeah, it was an abnormal ECG. And so they came to see me. And now we're having to work them up for something that's potentially life-changing, not just for them, but for other members of their family. And the additional testing can be very, very expensive. Mm-hmm. So someone who doesn't have insurance, getting an echocardiogram, a cardiac MRI, a treadmill stress test, a Holter monitor, we're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. That's the problem.
And the biggest problem that you're leading towards is a false negative or a false positive.
False positive.
What if they do all that and they, no, you're fine. You know, yes, you owe $3,000 in medical bills, but it was so. And how do you answer that? You can't, because you know you can't say, well, the whole one of the biggest arguments is that ECGs have a very high false positive rate, or higher than you want.
Right.
Whereas we just do straight echocardiography on everybody. Well, then you have a cost involvement and a time. And
right.
And I think I'm jumping ahead to a question I had is, what do you tell a kid? You had whatever this condition, whatever the results were, but what do you tell a kid that's been playing sports their whole life? And I give you the example of Baylor, basketball player a couple years ago. Plays his whole life, is an All-American or incredible athlete, never had a symptom, goes for a screen, goes for a physical. Oh, we found this true positive condition. You can never play that sport again. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's the psychological side from you? How do you approach that? I mean, it's got to be traumatic, obviously, for the athlete, but it's got to be hard to tell them that your livelihood that you planned on living
right.
with. How do you approach that?
That's one of the most difficult office visits that we come across. When we diagnose one of these conditions, like a long QT syndrome or a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or a coronary anomaly, you've got these teenage athletes that are the picture of health. And you're telling them that now they can't play sports, and it's devastating, not just for them, but for the families. They've been very active from a very young age, and maybe they're playing sports, looking to get a college scholarship to be able to further their career. And now you're telling them that that's not going to be an option. They won't be able to play sports. So it's a very difficult conversation. And I just had a couple of these recently. So what I tell the families that, what I told these families that I just saw recently, the child came in for a screening EKG. The screening EKG is our intent is to try to identify kids who may have a life-threatening condition that's going to put them at risk during strenuous physical activity. There are people out there who have these conditions and they don't know that they have it. Well, here we've potentially diagnosed your child with this condition. We need to do additional testing. You hear about these reports in the news all the time. A student athlete collapses during a practice or during a game or during a tournament, and the community is left wringing their hands. What could we have done to prevent this? So with these two children that I've just recently seen, we can potentially prevent a tragedy like that.
This is what we can do.
We've diagnosed that there is a real problem here. We have to do further testing. But I can't have you play sports. And they don't like to hear that, but this is why I'm telling you. You've never had symptoms before, but the day that you have symptoms may be your last day.
And because the first symptom is often called
for
death.
For some of these patients, yeah. Yes.
What do you see from a parent's side? Do you see relief, like, thank you for catching this, or do you see more of a standoffish, I don't care, I'm going to somebody else? Do you see both sides, or is it usually?
I see both sides. Really? I see both sides.
Can I jump in and ask something off that? Is it much harder to accept what you're telling them because it can't be seen? It's not a brace on a knee or an MRI showing everything's torn, or you can't throw a baseball anymore because your shoulder pops out. Is it much harder because they have nothing that they can go, that's the reason why?
I think accepting a diagnosis like this, families are going to go through all the stages of grief.
Sure.
And they're not going to go through all of those stages right in front of you during that,
right.
30 or 60 minute office visit. It's going to take some time for them to process that information and come to terms with it. I mean, at the very beginning, they're going to be very upset. Some are going to be sad and tearful, and others are going to be angry. And we see it all.
Right. I just didn't know how that process went with them. Considering, let's just take a catastrophic event of a season injury. Yeah, you know what's going on now. We can show you imaging versus, here's this on an echo.
Right.
This is what I think. To me, it's totally different. It's apples and oranges.
That, right.
Yeah, I know that doesn't hold my head up now like it should. I can't play
right.
football or whatever.
Right. It is a little bit more abstract.
Yeah.
Of course, it is a little bit more abstract. You can't see it on an X-ray.
Right.
We're talking about a genetic condition that's at the cellular level, ion channels and, cardiac myocytes.
Big
so it is right, exactly. It's a little bit
that you
right.
had and been playing it's, with absolutely fine for years.
Correct,
and
correct.
I see this, and now you can't play anymore.
Right. So there's some denial, and families, want to seek a second opinion, and we help facilitate that. I work with several outstanding cardiologists that will independently review the information and talk to the families, and we do additional testing to confirm our results.
I want to back up for just a second. It ties into part of what Mark was talking about earlier. You talked about it in there. I've said, as an employee of Memorial Hermann, though I don't speak for them, we could, in theory, ECG test every kid in the greater Houston area. We can't get them read. We don't have enough trained physicians that can read the test. Which goes to the second part of this, and why I say that is, you talked about it there, the machine says one thing.
Right.
And your read of this ECG is, you know, a polar opposite.
Right.
Can you touch on that real quick?
Right. So the EKG machines have algorithms to interpret the test and say it's normal, or, you know, there's this or that other abnormality. Sometimes the EKG machine is very accurate. Sometimes it can be way far off. And I gave the example during the conference. You know, I had a six-month-old come to see me to the office for evaluation of a murmur. Turns out it was an innocent murmur. We did an EKG, and the machine detected a pacemaker, where the child has never had surgery. There is no pacemaker in that little body. So I offer that as an example of why these EKGs have to be independently interpreted by a qualified physician. It doesn't necessarily need to be a cardiologist. I mean, pediatricians and family physicians and other interested healthcare professionals can be trained to read EKGs and be able to identify the abnormalities that require further follow-up versus the normal variants that we see in athletes.
So I'm going to kind of shift gears a little bit, and because of it's getting summertime and it's getting hot and football season's coming. So it's a common symptom of a heart condition, you know, wooziness or, you know, no energy, maybe lightheadedness. How do you, as a physician, and we have our students here, and we have, obviously, we're out trainers at a conference here, so it's a pretty relevant topic, but how do you differentiate a kid that's out of shape during 2 days versus a kid that has a potential heart condition that you're watching unfold?
Right.
How do you, you know, because, I mean, obviously 99.9% of them, their kids are just out of shape, and it's the heat and everything else. Is there something to look for? Is it more in the history? Or, you know, what guidance can you give us on that?
We could be here all day. the symptoms can be quite varied, and they're nonspecific. Sometimes kids will feel a little dizzy right during practices, and, you know, if you're practicing out in 105 degree weather and it's humid and you're out of shape, yeah, I think that's pretty understandable. But you have to have your index of suspicion always has to be high, because there could be someone out there that has a condition that hasn't been diagnosed. What I said during the conference, I feel very strongly about, that whenever there is any ambiguity or any doubt as to whether this child is out of shape or, you know, could they have a heart condition, I'm happy to see them. Because you, as athletic trainers, you're on the field and you're trying to make a quick, you know, game time decision. Whereas they come to see me in the office, I have all the diagnostic testing at my disposal. I have an EKG. I have the echocardiogram machine. I can turn those on at the click of a button. Mm-hmm. I can refer them for an x-ray and take a look at their heart and the lungs. I have all those tools at my disposal. So I don't put the onus on the athletic trainers or the pediatricians or family physicians to be perfect. I'm the safety net. I'm happy to see all of those components. If it's chest pain and you want me to figure out if it's cardiac or is it asthma or musculoskeletal, I'm happy to see them. The palpitations, is their heart racing because they're out of shape, or is it because they have an arrhythmia? I'm happy to see them.
I think for me, doing it early, everybody's out of shape. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's how we treat them and train them and see how they do. To me, the scary one is November, and they're conditioned and they're having these problems. Mm-hmm. That is no longer, unless they've been sick for a week of the flu, that's no longer dehydration. You know, lack of conditioning, that's something bigger and badder.
Right. I mean, there's a couple of situations where there are clearly red flags and are going to require a follow-up. Any child that collapses during a practice or during a game, that's a huge red flag. They need to see me. Any child that that you've noticed isn't able to keep up with their peers. So now it's November. You know, they've conditioned, they're in shape, but now over a series of a couple of weeks, you're noticing, man, they're getting very tired after just, you know, running 100 yards. That's not normal for that child anymore. You know, we need to evaluate them and see if something has something happened to their heart. Have they acquired a cardiomyopathy? You know, I mentioned during the conferences, people are going to develop a viral myocarditis every once in a while. In the winters, people are going to come down with the flu. Every once in a while, someone's going to develop a viral myocarditis. That flu virus affected the heart and is going to make a weak heart, and they won't be able to have the same level of exercise tolerance that they did before. So sometimes the symptoms may be a little bit subtle, but anyone that passes out during a practice, during a game, that's a huge red flag. I have to see them. Kids that complain that their heart starts racing for no reason when they're just, you know, sitting on the bench, that's a red flag as well, whether it happens during the game or at home. You know, paroxysmal palpitations sometimes are the first clue that there's an arrhythmia. So I evaluate them promptly as well.
All right, so let's, with that being said, let's shift gears again, medical history. And we talked about it outside. You were talking about the 12 points, I guess, for lack of a better word, through the American Heart Association, and showing how many at the high school, college, and professional level don't check all 12.
Right.
And I said to you, if you do the minimum, you're doing more than everybody else.
Right.
But let's look at in Texas alone. One of the questions, and I've had an argument about this for years, do you get short of breath while exercising? Well, yeah, I'm out of shape. I think a better question is similar to what we just said. Do you get short of breath while exercising after you've adapted to your sport?
Right.
To me, that's a bigger yes-no question. Because, you know, the kids come from, oh, it's hot, it was tough. Yeah, I got short of breath.
Right.
Or the mom says that. To me, it's a better question to say, you've been practicing for 6 weeks now, and you're having this problem. That, to me, is more sensitive question, I guess you could say, or...
It's a more specific question, right? So you're trying to rephrase the question to try to capture more pathology.
Right.
Let me put it to you this way. If I asked a child, has there been, or you know, in terms of family history, is there anyone in the family that died suddenly at a young age? The American Heart Association says anyone under 50. Well, what if I said anyone under 30 or anyone under 20? By moving that age of sudden death to younger ages, you're more likely catching some of these congenital heart defects or, you know, arrhythmias or hypertrophic cardiomyopathies. If I said, has anyone in your family died under the age of 60? Well, a bunch of them, exactly. A lot of people are going to die from coronary artery disease and high cholesterol and, you know, bad lifestyle. That's not really what we're trying to capture.
Right.
We're trying to identify the kids that have hypertrophic cardiomyopathies and arrhythmias and things like that. So by sliding that question, you know, anyone under 50 dies suddenly, anyone under 40 dies suddenly, anyone under 30 dies suddenly, you're selecting for a different type of positive response.
Right. I've said one of the things I've asked for was, I want a third box. You've got yes and no. I want unknown. So you ask that question, and we'll move it to 30. Has anybody in your immediate family died suddenly under the age of 30?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yes or no. What if you're adopted?
Right.
You don't know your medical history.
Right. And that, right, and that poses a big problem.
So unknown means for you or whoever's evaluating this individual, you've got to ask a few different questions mm-hmm. now and do a few different things to get a better interpretation and idea of what's going on.
Right. I had a child that came to see me last year for an evaluation. This child had been playing football for a couple of years and suffered a sprained ankle. Went to see his provider, and they heard a new murmur that hadn't been there before. So they referred him to me, and this child turned out to have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And the interesting thing is that as I'm asking the family history questions, it turns out that there are several aunts and uncles that died suddenly at a young age, in their 20s.
Wow.
You know, mid-20s, early 30s, several, I think three or four. So what this uncovered is that the child has a condition. We know that aunts and uncles have a condition, which means that someone in between, one of the parents, has a condition. And there's a 50% chance that the siblings have the condition. So I think that the history and physical part of our evaluation is very, very important, and we can be doing a lot better job than we are currently.
Right. One of my other arguments is the UIL only requires an annual physical examination in seventh grade, ninth grade, 11th grade, unless you answer yes to a certain subset of questions on the medical history. Well, the problem is, as you've alluded to, you change as you grow. You're changing every year, and it may be the one time a year that somebody's listening and feeling on them to look for anything going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they say every other year is finances, but yet you're going to throw in a potential ECG with massive financial implications to it.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't we better served mandating an annual physical examination as opposed to an ECG?
you know, I can't speak for what other states are doing, but I thought California was doing annual history and physicals, but I'm not sure on that.
A lot of districts here do it, but it's not required by the state.
It's not required by the state.
7-9-11. Mm-hmm. Your district can up it. A lot of districts do it, but that's a cheap, way cheaper alternative.
I would agree. You know, this childhood that had a murmur, you know, he may have been, you know, if he hadn't sprained his ankle, it may have been another year or two before he was diagnosed.
Right.
And all that time, he's potentially putting himself at risk.
Yeah. Did you have any questions?
I mean, we are in our general medicine class right now, so we've just gone over some of the cardiac abnormalities in we are taught to take a pretty good history, and basically our job during our PPEs is to find the murmurs and, you know, some of their, just like the syncope and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So our job is to, like I said, to find those and then refer them to a cardiologist or the physician. Do you think that would kind of eliminate the debate of the ECGs with PPEs if we can better our techniques as a clinician?
The EKG, when a child comes to see me for a pre-participation physical or clearance, let's say that they got flagged for some other reason, or you know, sometimes families just want a cardiologist to evaluate the child and get clearance instead of going to their primary care provider. They'll just come straight to me to get the clearance. If they don't have symptoms, if they don't have a family history, if they have a normal exam, I don't need to do an EKG.
Mm-hmm.
Again, and that's from the American Heart Association guidelines right now. I think if they've made it to my office, I probably will do an EKG as a screen. They're sitting right. They're already in my office. I can do an EKG very easily, and it does screen for a lot of different things all at once. But as I said in the conference, it's not a perfect test. I mean, when you have no symptoms, no family history, a normal exam, and a normal EKG, you can feel pretty reassured. I mean, that's a pretty good place to be. With everything coming back stars.
Some of the anti-ECG will argue against because they're not detectable, like the anomalous coronary artery.
Mm-hmm.
But they're just much less prevalent as well compared to HCM or mm-hmm. some other things.
Right.
And so I think what you're saying is very relevant. You don't have to do them, but, you know, if you're there, you know, you just do it simply. But, you know, one of the arguments is, well, to catch every condition, you have to do an ECG and
an
MRI.
Or an echo. Right.
You know, and... this is exactly it. You just keep adding things on.
Right.
When do you say enough is enough? And I think, you know, you get enough people say any family history is enough or take a good medical history. Then you add on some people say history and ECG, and I think that's where the debate comes. There's just no consensus because not everything's detectable by one test.
Right, and that's what I was alluding to in the conference as well. Sudden cardiac death isn't one entity. It's, you know, about a dozen or so different diagnoses. And an EKG, as good as it is, it also has some very important limitations. It's not a perfect test. I'll tell the families sometimes, you know, the EKG will occasionally indicate that there's left ventricular hypertrophy, you know, a case of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy potentially. But then we turn around and do an echocardiogram, and the echo is perfectly normal. Stone cold normal. There's no abnormal thickness. It's an athlete's heart, exactly. So that's why the Seattle criteria were developed to try to eliminate some of those false positives, right? By moving the scale a little bit higher and not just using the voltages alone, but looking at other abnormalities as well: axis deviation, T wave abnormalities, ST segment inversions, Q waves, etc. And then looking at those and screening those to see if they have hypertrophy. It's a screening test. It's not going to be perfect.
Exactly. It's a screening test.
It's a screening test. It's not. It's not a perfect test.
I look at ECG testing now as a car with airbags and a seatbelt. You have them, you use them, but there's no guarantee it's going to keep you from a death or a big catastrophic
right.
injury.
And I think that's an important part of the conversation with the families when they're coming in for these events, that they have to realize that it's not a perfect test. There are some important limitations.
Right. And going back to you girls talking about. you're going to learn. You've got to end up being like a customs agent. How you ask your question matters, and how you ask it to a seventh grader or a ninth grader or a 12th grader or a college athlete, you may have to ask the same question five different ways to elicit a decent response besides a move.
And a kid who wants to play versus a kid who doesn't really want to play.
Right.
Yeah.
Again, that's what I think is part of the flaw in the medical history of the PPEs is, you know, they're vague.
Yeah, but the argument comes up, what's better than that? Well, we don't have, you know, how do you get the perfect? Well, you talk to the parents and you make sure their answers are, you can't do that.
No,
so it's
can't.
Just, it's what but we you have.
You've got to take somebody's nose and double check them sometimes, you know, because how many of them will say they'll check yes to missing a paired organ? Did you read what we just said? So, you know, you've got to go through and look, do you have all your kidneys? Do you have the, you've got to go and further look at those.
Mm-hmm.
You can't take it all on face value. You got to make sure they understand. Even the parent check, they understand what they were asking.
Yeah, and you have to know your athlete pretty well.
You have to know your athlete.
If possible, yeah.
Which is tough to do with these mass physical screenings of 3,000 kids.
Well, even in your own school, and you've got 1,800 physicals that get turned in, you don't know all 1,800 kids. You hope to not know any of them because that means somebody got hurt.
And it's been shown it may not happen in athletics. It may happen in PE class.
Right.
You know, we know that very clearly. We have people at this conference that had to deal with that. And
right.
It's just, what do you do?
And you asked me about it yesterday about writing it up. I had a kid in 2013 in the fall, first week football practice, have a stroke, 16-year-old kid. Well, his stroke was caused by a cardiac abnormality, a PFO.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 25% of the population has it. Most of them don't know it. You know what you find out? Autopsy or echo. Well, he had no reason to get an echo until after he had a stroke.
Right.
So we're not going to go echo again every kid to go look for this.
You know? Right.
So.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, when you all screen lots and lots of kids when they're coming in for their physicals. Again, the message that I want to convey is I'm happy to see them anytime that you guys have any questions. You know, is this murmur, is it really there? Is it an innocent murmur? Is this abnormal? I'm happy to see them.
Which we hear once or twice a year. You hear it every day. So,
right.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard murmurs myself, and I've heard other people say, let's come listen to this. But when you do 1,800 of them in a day, you know, and you're getting behind schedule, and I've seen coaches, parents get mad at the coaches or the athletic director because the physicals are taking so long, and, you know, we're not the experts. We're there to screen, just like you said. You're there to diagnose. We're there to send, and, you know, it's very tough. And you talk about adding ECGs to 1,800 physicals. How long is that going to take? Now, the obvious question is, well, you can't put a time or a price on a human life. That's not what we're saying.
Right, that the physicals are taking long.
Right, you have to make it, you know, or you come
we're
in a different
day.
You come in on a different day. You know, freshmen come in. Well, then now all of a sudden the staff needs to be there, and you've got the kids got to be at school the next day. There's so many restrictions, so we're trying to find this happy medium of how do we keep everybody at least somewhat safe through a screening process versus doing one or two. We could act every kid, give them a ride to every kid, send every kid have them to a cardiologist screening session.
It gets pretty expensive.
But it's just every time, and in this part of the country especially, every time a death occurs, it's a media storm, it's a liability storm, you get state associations involved, you know, what can we do? How do we miss this? Well, just come to a physical screening. You'll see how much chaos there is.
And answer your medical history honestly.
Yeah, and make sure they understand it. But can you take the time to go through it and walk each kid through each question? You can't.
No.
You know, you'd love to and say, okay, here's what this question means. You know, is there
you're
anybody in your family? Tell
sure.
me if anybody that's died in the last 15 years before they were 40 years old. Well, I think my grandma died. Well, how old was she? She was 86. Would she die? I don't know. You know, okay, that's not what we're talking about.
Right.
So, you know, it's just athletics is big, and there's a big push on being active and everything, and so we want our kids and parents want our kids in. But there's also a catch-22 that they are at risk. If you put the body under stress, something could give. And so to catch that is, you know, and I'm speaking as somebody that hasn't had a child die. So I see one side of it more than another.
Right.
But when that happens, you get all these questions of, did you do everything you possibly could? Yes, we did. Would you give them ECG? No, we didn't. Why not?
Then you didn't do everything.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, you gave them an ECG. Why not an echo? Echoes are more diagnostic or
who's
more.
Paid?
Yeah, exactly. And
that
so
shouldn't matter.
It's a debate
it
that I don't think is ever going to end. I think, you know, until deaths stop happening in athletics, direct cause, or they'll move from, if they did stop from sudden cardiac death, it'll move to head injuries or something. And how do you stop that? you know, it's just it's we're in the middle of this. We want the kids to perform. We want them to be at their best.
Right. I mean, we want them to be active. We want them to be healthy. Yeah. And the with the obesity epidemic the way it is, you want these
exactly.
kids to play sports.
Exactly.
You want them to be in shape because the long-term health consequences of them not being healthy probably outweigh mm-hmm. Some of these risks of
participating. And there's a correlation
participating.
Between activity in youth and activity as you get older and
of
weight
course.
In your youth and weight.
Yes,
so it's
exactly.
just we're trying, you know, we're helping them and we want them to succeed, we want them to be fit, but yet it's not just going out and walking on a treadmill. I mean, this is physical contact, it's out in the heat, high stress, high humidity. It's like you're putting them in the perfect storm of something to happen. If one enzyme is off, you've got Brugada syndrome, you know, sudden cardiac death.
Right.
You know, and it's not a... not a happy place to be.
You still go back to history and physical, but we should not be legislating athletes out of participating.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're in essence doing, if it comes to that.
To an extent, yeah.
It comes to it.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Do you guys, Allison?
I just had a question just going kind of back to, I know someone kind of at the end of the conference, they told you a story about the mother had checked no to everything. How can we convey to the parents when we're in our meetings at our high schools or even at colleges, how can we convey to them the importance of you need to be honest with us because otherwise,
you put a penalty to go along with it.
And they want their kid to play.
Right.
So.
My kids are next Olympian. My kids get a scholarship. Until the parent is held responsible somehow, I don't know that you can.
That I think it'll be impossible to guarantee that everyone's being honest on the questionnaire. I think what we can do is try to convey to them the importance of being truthful. You know, we want to make sure that their kids are safe. And we can only guarantee that, or we can only try to make that possible to the extent that they're truthful on their questionnaires. We want to know if there's any prior surgical history, any prior cardiac conditions that they're aware of, that we should be aware of, to be able to take the appropriate precautions. Just because a child has a heart condition doesn't mean that they're going to be restricted from doing all sports or even the sport that they want. Some of these children that I was mentioning to you earlier that I found in the office doesn't mean that they can't do any sport because not every sport has the same degree of physical exertion and demands on the cardiovascular system. So on one extreme, you might have boxing or MMA or football, and on the other extreme, you can have a child do golf. Golf is a sport
it's
as
like
well.
Asthma doesn't preclude you from any sport. It's just we need to monitor you because we know you have it.
Exactly.
It can happen at any time.
That's right.
So let's match you up with something to best prevent that.
Now, golf may not be the first choice for a lot of kids, and it may be a big downshift for the football player who now says he can't play. We tell him he can't play football, but you can play golf, and you can have a very lucrative professional career as a golf player.
You'll be walking when you're 50.
Exactly, and be safe, right?
Your knees
and
won't
be safe.
Bothering the rest of your life.
And be safe.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, I think you probably have to get out and back to work.
So. Right. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. Thanks to Jeremy for letting us do this.
Dr. Ramos, I enjoyed our interview.
All right. Thanks, guys. Thank you for the invitation. Awesome.
Thank you for your time.